When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
Hello, everyone. I am Ben Johnson, and this is the Perpetual Chess Podcast. Perpetual Chess is a weekly interview show where top chess players, authors, content creators, and accomplished amateurs discuss their careers and share stories and chess improvement tips. Perpetual Chess is a part of the Blue Wire Podcast Network, and we'd like to give a special thanks to our presenting chess education sponsor, Chessable.com. For more information about the show, you can go to perpetualchesspod.com. But without further ado, let's get to the show. Hello, everyone, and welcome back to Perpetual Chess. We are joined by a NYC area chess blitz legend, trainer, chessable author of the Yak Attack, Carol Khan for Black. He collaborates with Elijah Logazar, who some of you may have heard as an accomplished adult improver here on this podcast a couple years back. He's the five-time World Open Blitz champion, and we are pleased to welcome to the show International Master Yakov Norwitz. Welcome, Yakov.
Thank you very much, Ben. It's an honor, real honor to be on, and I appreciate it.
Sure, yeah, happy to have you. As we were just discussing, we're from roughly the same generation, the same social circles, but we've never had a chance to chat, and I'm excited because my first memories of you, Yakov, are circa 2000. You just terrorizing people on the internet chess club.
I love it.
Good at Blitz in those early days. So I wanted to start by talking about Blitz. How does one become a Blitz specialist if you even consider yourself a Blitz specialist, as I sort of do when I think about it? I should mention, by the way, Yakov has a peak chess.com Blitz rating of 2993.
Well, when you say, do I consider myself Blitz, how do you mean?
Do you consider speed chess your specialty, or do you just think you're an all-around chess player when you think of yourself?
I play all around, but I know it's definitely my specialty, both in level and in desire. Like, I just love I love Blitz, and I think I've always been in like my best mojo for Blitz. Like, I just 34-19 was my peak in ICC. It's funny even thinking like that's pretty high, and I just love the fight. In Blitz, you just chill there, you play, the game's over before you know it, there's nothing to fear. You just the game's over. So you're in the moment, there's no overthinking ever. And you play the same person again, ostensibly, sometimes many times. So it just feels good. It feels like it's you really get in the battle, and I just love the battle for its own sake. So I think I brought my best mentality to Blitz always.
And Yakov, you mentioned in one of your Chessable videos that you played Hikaru Nakamura over 10,000 times.
12,000.
Well, that's over 10,000.
yes. It is.
So let's hear about it. I mean, that must be nuts.
I knew Hikaru before he knew how to play chess. Like, so his older brother Asuka. Sunil used to bring him down to the Westfield Chess Club. I was born in 82. Maybe I was like 15. I was maybe close to master, give or take, and maybe 16. I just made master, and Asuka was like 11 or 12. He's like an expert. I used to play him sometimes. He was there, and Hikaru was out on the monkey bars, and he didn't even know how to play chess. He was like 6 years old. He didn't know how to play. So I knew Hikaru even before he knew how to play. We played once in a tournament, actually. Once when he was eight.
Let's hear the story. How'd it go?
How delicious. Yes. It was a good one. He was 8 years old, and it was my Hikaru Khan. And it was a nice, it ended in a, it was a miniature. I remember which table it was, exactly which table.
Was that in Westfield as well?
That was in the Marshall Chess Club. That was okay. In a 30-minute game in the Marshall Chess Club. And it was a miniature that I sacked my queen, or was about to sack my queen to get a Bowdoin's mate, a crisscross, bishop mate, and he resigned and moved before.
Do you have the game?
Oh, I don't.
Man, that would be awesome.
I can maybe try to recreate it. I don't know.
Yeah, maybe offline. But tell us more about the Blitz, because I mean, it sounds like you had sort of a unique perspective getting to see Hikaru rise up through the ranks. I also, by the way, played as his older brother Asuka, who was a prodigy in his own right.
Yes.
He was younger than me and beat me a couple times in my teens. And then I only got to play Hikaru once in a tournament game. Obviously, I lost. He was already, you know, you got to catch these kids when they're like six.
Very young. Six.
Sorry. he was already an adult when I played him. So no shot for me. But anyway, I mean, could you talk a little about his development, and was there a moment where you realized like this kid is special? I mean, obviously you're pretty special yourself, but Hikaru being world class, was there a moment where that struck you?
We played a lot, and I don't mean to brag, but I think in Blitz I am world class, but he's like world. He is the world. He's the best. I mean, in Bullet, I think he was the best ever at a certain, by far. I mean, in Bullet, he used to terrorize people. People don't realize, but in Bullet a few years back, he was above Carlson by far. Like, it was not even close. But I played him maybe the year 2000, maybe before that. I probably played him in the late 90s. And I think he just became really good really quick. I don't know. Like, I almost don't remember a time when in Blitz I was ahead of him. That's the truth. That's the weird part. Even when he was just special. He was special. And he was the one guy I was intimidated by. You know, I was not. I just loved the fight. I would play like top like 27 feet A's. Like, and it was just like a fight. I would just love the stronger they were, the more I would just dig in and enjoy. But he was just intimidating. I don't know. It just got to me.
That's funny, because 5 years younger than you. So we're talking like there must have been a period where you're like, you know, 16 and he's 11, but he was still intimidating.
Maybe when he was 11, he wasn't. I don't know if I play him then. He was even then intimidating, I guess. We're 12. I remember I watched when he made the I think I was in the Manhattan Chess Club when he made some GM norms. I think the day I came to watch, he lost that. He was looking at me, I think. He remembered that game when I beat him when he was little. I feel like I got in his head a little. I didn't try. But, when he was 13, 14, I remember even when he was an IM, he was incredible. Like, just, like, really special. We played a lot of Bullet. We used to play in the ICC in the one-minute pool.
Let's hear about this Bullet thing, because I mean, you're kind of in a unique perspective to judge the relative skill of these world-class Bullet players. You say that he was definitely better than Magnus. What informs that perspective, Yaakov?
His rating was one of a kind. It was like Michael Jordan above everyone else. Tiger Woods, maybe. Remember in the Bullet pool, everyone else was 2800 Grishuk. Again, like in this thing, when I played a lot Bullet, I was definitely in the top, like that's why I was in world class, but Blitz also, but he was like one of a kind. Like, he's not even his own category, especially, but he was like 3,100. He was 3,100 when everyone else was like 28.
Okay. And you've played like Andrew Tang and
Andrew Tang is more recent. Yeah, that's interesting. Andrew Tang. I played him back in the day, Penguin. Yeah. And he's really good too, but I would be fine against him. Again, maybe he got a little better. And when you get a little older, you get a little slower. You just do.
Right. Yeah. You're 40 now. And what about, and this might be sort of, you may have missed the Faruja generation, but have you played Faruja?
I played Faruja many, many, many times, but like right when he was IM, we played every day. FM Faruja, okay. Like on chess, every day. Like, we played. I don't play much these days. And then Bullet, I don't know. I you have to really want to win. You have to be like angry every time you play. I'm not that angry, for better or for worse. That's a whole discussion in itself.
Yeah, I mean, as you get older, you know, your perspective, your priorities change.
Exactly, and maybe that's healthy, but that's it is what it is. I did some yoga like a couple of years ago, and I told the yoga teachers, like, this is bad for my chest. I'm just too relaxed. Like, what's... And they said, no, yoga teaches you to balance and to bring out... And I'm like, no, I think you don't understand what chess is. You have to be, like, some deep, like, I don't know, angry, but you have to be really fiery all the time when you play. If you're too balanced, you may not have that all the time, you know, so...
Yeah, when I spoke most recently with Grandmaster Jakob Augard, he was talking about the Magnus quote where he says, like, you have to be a shark. And he was saying, like, that's what he looks for when evaluating, like, the Abdusatarovs of the world and Gukesh and people like that. Like, and yeah, so it sounds like you used to be a shark.
Absolutely. Yeah, I'm like angry. I didn't know what I was angry. I think nowadays I kind of do know. That's it's complicated, but and it's not necessarily unhealthy. Maybe that's fine. It's just... It had a huge place in my life in that, but I still love Blitz, but I feel like Bullet is just a desire to win. You have to want it so bad every game, and I also when you teach, it's different. You're like in nurture mode. It's different. It's a different mode. I'm like
I get it for sure. Now let's bring it back to the Bullet battles with Hikaru. Uh-huh. Obviously, you say you're a world class Bullet player, but he was even a step above that. When you played him, was there a certain factor that differentiated him, or was he just better at everything?
Oh, wow. He had no nerves, no nerves. Nothing unfazed. So, like, he would just, like, absolute vicious. His calculation was weird. Like, I remember used to try to think of what's going on. Something, doesn't feel like human. And it reminds me of Naroditsky. He's getting really dangerous too, obviously for Rouge. But like Naroditsky's special talent like that. Anyway, his positionally, I felt like I was okay with him. Like positionally, understanding wise, when I could keep the game tame, I could squeeze him like my cheesecake opening.
Yes, we got to talk about the cheesecake later.
I have some miniatures against Hikaru. That I have the game. I have to find it, and I did not find it for Chessel, but I could definitely find it somehow. I could recreate it, and it was a beautiful cheesecake. Traded queens early, and then sometimes not. Hikaru just felt like it became ordinary again. There were times, those moments in the game, but it was. I had to be in the right state of mind, and the queens had to come off for sure. A few things had to happen.
Okay, and of course, you mentioned you've seen him since he's a little kid. You're from New Jersey. He's from New York. So I'm sure you've had many, many online battles, as you alluded to, 12,000 plus games and 10,000 plus. But I'm curious, like, did you ever have any Blitz or Bullet, like old school in-person sessions with Hikaru where you just sit there for hours and battle, or did that never happen?
Yeah, not hours. I remember years back, and I was definitely weaker then. I definitely knew less about chess. I don't know. I forget how long ago, but it was in Washington Square Park. My buddy Noah Siegel. I don't know if you know Noah Siegel.
Yeah, I know. You do know. I remember him. Yeah.
You remember him. Yeah. And he, there was like a game they had set up with Hikaru with John Jarecki for a lot of money for a game, but it was like 5-1 or something. They were playing like a lot of money, like $10,000. It was a lot. And a game. And I was like a warmer up. I played Hikaru for $100 a game. I think Noah staked me. I think we actually lost at like 5-1. So it was embarrassing. But the thing is, 1 minute is enough for Hikaru. It's the same. It doesn't matter.
It's not that different. Yeah.
It's not that different. I feel like though these days, I feel like I'm a favorite. I just feel that. I'm not sure if I'm right.
Uh-oh, shots fired. We got to arrange the
Hikaru-Yaka 5-1. Yeah, exactly. But we played a little in person then. It was about, I think he beat me like a bunch. He squeezed me in his d4. I don't know. I didn't know what I was doing in opening back then at all. Now I know a little bit. But we played in person then. We played the World Open, I think. One of the World Open blitzes that I won, he was there. It was a cut. We tied for first. So that was actually, I think, my thing I'm most proud of the five. It was a tie. So we played there. I think we drew. So I was proud of that.
Yeah, no, I would be too. So, Yakov, I want to hear a little more about your Blitz upbringing. Specifically, you learned from the legend Roman Djindjashvili. But first, Yakov, we need to take a break and hear from our sponsors. So we'll be right back. Perpetual Chess is brought to you in part by aimchess.com. aimchess has an algorithm that gathers your games from the major chess playing sites like chess.com and leechess and then gives you actionable intel on how to improve your game. It evaluates different phases of the game, tells you how you're doing with certain openings, and they're constantly rolling out new features to make Aim Chess even better. Some of the new ones include a blunder preventer drill that you can do, and they've now got blindfold exercises where you can work on your chess visualization skills. So be sure to check out Aim Chess if you have not already. And if you decide to subscribe, then use the code PERPETUAL30 to save 30%. You can also click on the link in the show description to aimchess.com. You should know what that sound means. That's the sound of another sale on Shopify and the moment another business dream becomes a reality. Shopify is the commerce platform revolutionizing millions of businesses worldwide. So whether you're selling chess courses, chess boards, or something totally unrelated to chess, Shopify simplifies selling online and in person so you can focus on successfully growing your business. It covers every sales channel, whether it's in-person point of sale system or an all-in-one e-commerce platform. It even lets you sell across social media like TikTok, Facebook, Instagram, packed with industry-leading tools ready to ignite your growth. It gives you complete control over your business. And thanks to 24/7 help and an extensive course library, Shopify is there to help you every step of the way. What's incredible to me about Shopify is how no matter how big you want to grow, Shopify is there to empower you with the confidence and control to revolutionize your business and take it to the next level. So now it's your turn to get serious about selling to Shopify. So sign up for a $1 a month trial period, shopify.com/chess. By using the code chess, you know that they came from Perpetual Chess. So that's shopify.com/chess to take your business to the next level today. And we are back. So, Yaakov, you had the opportunity to learn chess from an early age from a legend, from Grandmaster Roman Djindjishvili, who was also a world-class player and also like a legendary sort of chess, I don't know if hustler's the word, but blitz specialist, played a lot of games for money. So obviously, I'm curious what you learned generally from a player of that stature, but I'm also curious about like if you feel like you learned under his blitz tutelage.
Interesting. I think he gave me an intuitive way of playing. He just taught me to a deep understanding. And I think for blitz, you just need that understanding. You just not too much calculating. He was a natural player, and I think he did give me that natural. He would say things, and he wouldn't explain them really well. He'd let me figure that out, like double fold. Give me these openings, which are very shaky, and he would let me figure them out. But it was an intuitive way of play. It wasn't like calculated. It was very intuitive, and that was helped me become a strong blitz player. And he gave me a great deep understanding too. I mean, just how he approached stuff was so deep, and it rubbed off.
And did you do like sparring matches with him?
That's the story. So we played online a few times, and I think I flagged him once. It was ugly. It wasn't that good. Yeah, not you know, so. Anyway. But no, we didn't play. We didn't. No. Oh, we did. We did when I was little, actually. And he crushed my stone wall a couple times. He forced me to learn the cheesecake because he would play King's Indian against my stone wall, and no good.
Okay. We've mentioned it twice now, so I know, but it's time to explain for our listeners what the cheesecake is, just for anyone uninitiated.
Oh, yeah. The cheesecake is like a smooth, like so I have an opening for D4 that I made a chessable course about, and it's an old opening called the Stonewall Attack. I think it's not known to be a very deep opening or very complex, and it doesn't really have the best reputation, but I feel like we've given it some depth with some deep ideas behind the surface and make it into a weapon. I feel like we've made it into a weapon. But then if they do a certain defense, the King's Indian, it doesn't work. I learned it the hard way many, many times. I feel like Greg used to punish me too. And then I got punished a lot of times. But then I made something. One day I started forming lines to play, and it was called I named it the cheesecake because it's smooth like cheesecake. So that's, you'll enjoy it. It's very easy to learn, and it's I got some good results.
So this is covered in Elijah Logazar and Yaakov's course on the Stonewall. Yeah, and it's great to have a name like the cheesecake, you know, I'm sure evocative and, you know, helps bring home the idea. So anyway, you were discussing working with Roman Djindjishvili and that helping cultivate the cheesecake. But I'm curious, Yaakov, what were the nature of your lessons with him? Like, were you analyzing games? Was he showing you Grandmaster games? Was he giving you in-game studies, all of the above? What did you guys do?
It's really an interesting story how we started. Like, I started in Elizabeth, New Jersey in my school. Like, so before Roman, maybe if I was okay, I can mention.
Of course.
Before Roman, I went to the chess. My dad told me how to play chess when I was six and I forgot. And then and then like 2 years later, my dad told me, like a friend, Leo Schwartz, and then he told me how to play, and I forgot. And then my dad told me one day, my dad used to play a bit. He had books, a lot of Irving Shirner books and Fred Reinfeld books. And it's interesting. I just play. He likes this stuff. He never played it in tournament ever, but he loved the game. And he taught me. And then I went to in my school, in a Jewish school, a Jewish educational center. There was a chess club, and Dr. Richard Lewis, who was my dentist at the time, he gave the chess club, and it was free. And then he saw I had talent. I remember one day my dad told me, Dr. Lewis wants to offer to teach you for free. Are you interested? And I was like, of course. So he told me for a couple of years, and I got to maybe, I was probably like 1100 level. My first rating was 12 or 1300. I don't know. And he got me to maybe 1700 or 1800 after about 2 years. I was like 11. And then he couldn't teach me anymore. So then he had Roman, who is his patient, give me free. He would give Roman free dental work in return that Roman would teach me.
That's amazing.
It's amazing. It's like a literal miracle, and it's special. If not for Doc, I wouldn't be playing.
That's interesting. I believe he does now, but I thought Gingy lived in the Massachusetts area.
He does. He lived. Yeah, now he does. I think then he lived in New York. He was. Okay. He had some chess and backgammon club in Midtown back in the day, near Bryant Park. He's still. Yeah. This is back in 96, back in 95, okay. Maybe. So I used to go out of school once or every other week. The rabbi said he liked chess too. Middle of the day, I would go to learn some chess. We'd eat some bagels together in the dentist's office. And then we'd have lessons. And what would he do? He would go over my games, definitely go over every game of mine that I played in tournaments. He would show me, he told me some openings. He would put out a lot of moves at a time, and he was like, I feel like he would purposely do original stuff, like the sharp openings, the sharp positional stuff. And I didn't understand at the time, but I would work to understand it over time.
Okay, so it was mostly opening work you did with him.
Mostly opening work. We did some. He would show me nice positions. I remember he showed me a whole lesson about a knight on f5. I remember how a knight on f5. He showed me a lot of different positions, how certain structures were dangerous for one player.
And Yaakov, you obviously had a pretty fast chess trajectory. Aside from your lessons, were you reading books? Were you doing puzzles? I know you played a ton. What would you say contributed to your fast rise?
I would read, devour books. I would just devour. I would read a book, and if the book is over, I would be sad because I need a new book. Like, I'm like, oh, so I would just just devour. And I don't think that's standard. It's a little unstandard. I didn't know that it was unstandard. I also never cared about reading at all. It's like also unstandard. Just like, I remember one day I'm like, oh, my rating shot up a couple hundred points, and now I'm top 50 in age in the country for my age. And I was like, oh, I remember the thing, like, oh, that's nice. And I was like, I didn't really care. So I think that helps. I think that when you're just enjoying the game, it's no ego, just enjoying it goes a long way. I would play every weekend usually also.
So spending a lot of time on chess and self-motivated, it sounds like.
Yeah, yeah.
And what were your favorite books back in the day?
I like Capablanca's Best Chess Endings by Irving Chernev.
Classic, 60, yeah.
Classic, yeah. I read it like 10 times. Yeah. Just like over and over. I could not. Nims of Ish was too hard. For some reason, I know it's a classic, but I somehow it's too intense for me. That wasn't my
Thank you. I just recorded a big book conversation with the Chess Dojo guys. Shout out to them. And I was discouraging them from they basically recommend books for their students, and I was telling them don't put my system in there. You're gonna lose subs.
It's too hard. I love it. But this is like a book which is like your encyclopedia. It's an encyclopedia. It's like it's almost like Nims Rich tried not to make it fun. He wanted to like get a
exactly
point. like hey, this is my this is not for your enjoyment. This is for my theory. Praxis I like. Praxis I like because he's a try. He begins to make it interesting.
I'll have to check that out. Shout out to David Proust. He recommended Praxis, and to be fair, I haven't read that one in its entirety because I revisited my system as an adult because I read it as a kid, and at the time there wasn't that much around, so I had reasonably fond memories of it. But when I reread it, I was like, oh, there's so much new stuff is so much better. But I'll check out Chess Praxis. But anyway, Capablanca's Chess Endings, great book for, I would say, 1500 to 2000 level especially, but really both below and above that as well. Chernev's just a fantastic annotator. Any other recs before we move to the next topic?
I like Jeremy Silman. Jeremy Silman is awesome. He just explains things really, really well. I mean, it's just great. It's great. And I would also say, like, I know this is controversial, but I don't think computers really too helpful for people. I just don't think it hurts my game. I mean, it literally hurts my game when I look at a computer. I mean, this is just
how does it hurt your game?
Because I stop thinking. I forget how to think. It like switches into and also makes everything absolute. And I don't think that's bad. Maybe that's just my issue. It could be, but I think it makes it absolute, good or bad. And I think in chess you have to fight. It does you bad position. You just assume you're better. It doesn't matter. You can't change it anyways. you can't change it. You fight it out. I think that was some endgame book. Let's see what other Irving Chernev, Fried Reinfeld, all his book. Oh, how to see three moves ahead in chess. What is that? Seeing three moves ahead or logical chess move by move? Of course, was
yeah, of course a classic.
Classic. Yeah.
Excellent. So. Were you doing tactics, or was it primarily reading books?
I did a lot of easy tactics. I did a lot of, I guess that was logical chess. You know, I would go through it. I didn't do any, like, positions where I had to spend time on. I definitely didn't do that. Probably most of my tactic work was blitz. Playing blitz was probably helpful. A lot of end games. I loved end games. Actually, my coach, Doc Lewis, before I met Roman, I didn't know any openings. So Doc said, you got to start with the end games. So I would lose, and he taught me a few openings just to get by, but he didn't really. So it was good for me long term because I built a foundation. I think Capablanca said you got to start with endgames and then openings. Now, the problem is I actually didn't know any. So for openings, so for a while, I only had an opening for black. So if I'm white, I would play A3 just to be black. I would play a waiting move.
So funny. And this is in slow chess too, or just
yeah, blitz? Slow chess. When I was a kid, I didn't know what I'm doing. I didn't know what. Yeah, slow chess too.
And this did you enjoy? Did you enjoy slow? You mentioned that you didn't care as much about rating, which I agree with you. That's great if one can cultivate that mindset. But did you enjoy slow chess as much as you did blitz?
Slow chess much. Back in the day, I loved it even more.
Oh, really?
Even more. Yeah. I think tournaments were like a carnival. Going to tournaments, it was special. It was like, wow. And I did. I just thought it was interesting. Back in the day better? I think I was always better in blitz. I just, you know, as I just felt more natural, played fast. Maybe I saw things quick. I don't know.
Yeah. And do you, with blitz, would you say you primarily learned from playing? Or, I mean, was there like a differentiation between getting good at blitz and your overall chess improvement? Or was it just kind of all muddled together?
It went together. Oh, I didn't play blitz till I was maybe 13. Until I joined ICC. A little before ICC. So maybe 12. But at 12, I was... around 12, I think that's actually when the one time I won the Parsifony. I was on board four. I was around 2000 before Parsifony. So I didn't play Blitz maybe till I was a little before that. Let's say 1800. I didn't play any Blitz till I was 1800. But when I played, I think I jumped up pretty quickly.
And Yakov, in terms of like your chess development, did you ever consider yourself like, I know I asked you, were you a Blitz specialist, but did you decide I'm going to play more Blitz and play less tournaments, or did you, your interest in tournaments continue, like into your 20s?
Definitely in my 20s. I liked it. I like both. I think I liked tournaments. Maybe the past 10 years a little bit less. It's just you play so much that 2 hours at the board you start wondering what to think about. It's hard. And also I'm playing like the top players. It's hard to be excited when you're playing every day like top players. It's hard to get excited. I definitely in my 20s, and I still love slow chess as long as I'm inspired that day.
And aside from Hikaru, who were your toughest opponents in Blitz? I mean, or OTB for that matter.
Right. So Hikaru's, when you say Blitz, you mean Blitz bullet loosely, right? You mean?
Yeah.
Okay. All the same. Naroditsky. No, I used to play like Rav a lot. So my best bullet per day, okay, was back in ICC 1 minute pool. Now, does anyone, ICC 1 minute pool was you click one, and then it hits you with someone close to your rating. So I would get it like Smallville. That was his name. Smallville. Yeah. You'd be like, fear. I still like a little bit, but excitement too. Fear and excitement. Okay. That's somewhat. Now there's another one, Lagrav. I forgot what his name was. The username? Anyways, but
was it Leon Beast? I know he was using
Leon Beast,
that.
Thank you. Leon Beast. I think that was his name. But that's his name on chess.com. Maybe it was also his name there. I don't remember if that was all. And we played. I remember beating him six in a row. That was what a beautiful day. Six in a row bullet. So.
And what about OTB? Do you have any like, and did you play any legends? Or do you have like a favorite win?
There's not OTB. Carlson, I've beaten maybe. In my academy, we have one of the games, early video, a game where I beat Carlson in the cheesecake. Color ideas. yeah. So the students will enjoy it. But on the OTB, I haven't, though. I haven't played that many. I played it well in some Blitz tournaments in Iceland. I did well. Legends on the board. No. I used to play Anand a lot. For a while, it was like maybe 10 years, more than 10 years ago. It was... I don't know. It was maybe like 2000. I don't actually remember. I don't know. But there was a period where about 6 months, someone set us up. Someone, a friend who I knew and from South America, he knew Anand, and we played on a small server. We played a lot, and we chatted a lot too. He's really not just chess and other, just chatted, and he's really really nice, and it was really really special. I would meet him sometimes. He said one of my favorite things I ever heard. He said Yakov, that its stonewall attack is the Yakov attack.
The
Yakov attack. Even I played against him.
The stonewall is the Yakov. That's great.
You say the Yakov attack, and he was smiling. That was fun. But I played him, but that was not on the board. I saw him in Israel like a year later. I was a bit shy to say hello, but anyway. Not as much on the board. Not as much. I mean, I played a lot of very strong grandmasters. I remember Wojcikowicz. We played a lot in the Blitz, World Blitz. We played, I played everyone in the States mostly, but yeah.
Okay. Well, it's fun to hear these stories about playing all these legends and to add to the folklore of Anand being a nice guy.
Nice. Oh, he's just fun, down to earth. We were joke about it. Fun, pleasant stuff, every fun stuff that you would never imagine this or not. Oh, and I had a few years ago in a Millionaire Open. There was two in Vegas and there was one in Atlantic City that Maurice Ashley made, the Millionaire Chess Open. I don't know if you're
yeah.
So there was a Blitz. I didn't play the one in Atlantic City, but I decided to come in for the blitz. So I was like in a groggy mood that day. I remember it was, I think, in Harris. I was in a groggy mood, but I'm there and I wanted to play, but I really didn't really want to be around people and didn't really want to play chess. So I decided, let me get, and I don't know if this is great for the air, but I decided to get a little bit drunk and I had like 6 or 7 shots of vodka and I won the whole event. I won the whole 10-0. And so, yeah, this is not a recommend, obviously, but it's funny how that works.
Don't I mean, that. There's that famous story about Magnus, like, getting tilted at the World Rapid and Blitz and hitting the mini bar and then going on a tear and winning a bunch of games.
Interesting.
So it can be done. I mean, they say in pool that in billiards, like 2 drinks is the sweet spot. And then you play better for your first couple drinks and then it goes downhill. And I think there may be some truth to that in chess, but every once in a while things click.
It's click. And I assume he like literally carried me to the board. It was a strong event too. The last round I played in Cuba, number 3 player in Cuba, which I forget his name now. Anyway, it was like 2650. Anyway, but it was 2-0. He was very disturbed because he knew I was drunk too. He knew
right, I was yeah. Yeah, that can be intimidating. Fun stories. All right, well, we got to take one more break, Yaakov. And when we come back, we have a listener question for you and some other things to discuss. We'll be right back. Perpetual Chess is brought to you in part by Chessable.com. Chessable is the leading chess education platform known for its proprietary move trainer technology, which uses space repetition to help you remember stuff. What kind of stuff? Well, tactical patterns, opening sequences. It can even help you drill specific endgames. And of course, they have a huge library of courses to help you do that. They have courses both from prominent grandmasters like Grandmaster Jordan von Forrest, Magnus Carlsen, Sam Shanklin, and they also have great material for club players, from club players. They have stuff for purchase, stuff you can check out for free. So be sure to go to chessable.com and check out what they have that is new. And we are back. And Yaakov, you and Elijah's courses have quite good reviews, I must say, on Chessable. I was pretty impressed with them. And we have a question from a supporter of the podcast, Alex Marler. Thanks for helping to support Perpetual Chess via Patreon, Alex. And he asks if you have any plans for a new Chessable course for black versus 1D4 that follows your color method, or if you're planning to make a strategic course using your color method, which of course means you should first off explain the Dacha color method.
Okay, here we go. And it's without a board, so it's going to be a little tricky, but we're going to try. We're going to try our best. Without a board, guys, you got to look at the board, look at the academy for more, because without a board is only without a board. But here it goes. Okay, so basically in chess, we have 64 squares, of course. We have 32 light squares, 32 dark squares. We think of it as control, as one board, one battle. And we're trying to control that board. We're trying to control the board, and some parts are more important than others. Maybe the center is more important, fair enough. But I like to look at it, and I'll maybe mention afterwards how I came to understand and discover these ideas. But I like to approach it as two boards. There's actually two boards going on at the same time. There's two boards, two struggles, a light board of 32 light squares, and a dark board, a dark struggle of 32 dark squares. And they're both important, of course. And we're trying to build in harmony, a balance of light and dark. And so, example, let's bring it a little bit more down to earth. We have a bishop only controls one color. Let's say a light bishop. It's great on light, useless on dark. Okay. So we give it currencies. Okay, a light bishop is $1,000 of light, $0 of dark. Yeah, and it's currency in fluctuation. So right in the beginning, light and dark are equal importance, we imagine, probably. But okay, light bishop, $1,000 of light. And stop me if I'm going too much, but a dark bishop is $1,000 of dark. Okay, but zero equity on light. Okay, a knight. We don't even think of it as a necessary color piece. It could help control squares, but no, it is a color piece. It's light and dark, but it's not a specialist. It's not intense. It's not long range like a bishop, but it can get to either color at a moment's notice. So a knight is $500 of light and $500 of dark. Okay. Just the rules of chess basically be worded in a sense. But here's where it comes in, and here it gets interesting. Where, like, in terms of strategy, let's say you lose a light bishop. Okay, the books will say, oh, you're maybe weak on that color. Okay, well, how do you make up for that for the missing bishop? You're going to put the pawns. If you lose a light square bishop, you got to replenish the light, replenish harmony. So you put the pawns. People will say, you close the position against his bishop. Yeah, that's not wrong. None of this stuff is wrong, but it's really, you want to build your own bishop. So if I lose a light square bishop, if we lose a light square bishop, we're going to want to rebuild with pawns. Let's say a pawn chain, but it's actually a miniature bishop because, again, each pawn is controlling that square next to it, a diagonal. So you're building a handmade light bishop. And that's the one. And also, if you lose a light bishop, like, oh, I lost light, I gain a knight, whatever. A knight is a knight. It is what it is. But you actually gain, if you do the math, just the math, it's actually straight math. You invest a light bishop for a knight. I'm not going to go into any positions right now, but Grand Prix attack would be a good example. Whoever knows. But let's say bishop b5 takes c6. Okay, but let's say you lose a light square bishop, take a knight. You're investing 1,000 light for 500, which means the net is that you're losing 500 light, but you're gaining 500 dark. You now have another knight. So if you attack any darks around the board, you actually could attack it more times than they can. Like, you have more dark equity. Like, you could actually clobber him on any dark. Pick a dark square and it's yours in a perfect world. Okay, obviously there's things that happen in the interim. But that's, mathematically, you're ahead on dark. So you're behind on light. Rebuild that with pawns. And you're ahead on dark and try to press it with pieces. Press your stronger color with pieces. First of all, know the math. And then press it and rebuild with pawns, a weaker color.
Okay.
It's an adventure. You trade people bishop, knight. I can't hung up with this. Open-minded, and you make your own narrative.
Speaking of open-minded, so I've seen you talk about this in your Chessable course. You write about it a bit on your website, on a blog. But first of all, I got to ask the hard-hitting questions, Yaakov. When you dreamed up the Dacha theory, were there any drugs involved?
No, there was not, actually. There was not. Like, sometimes inspiration comes when you're with drugs.
And it just seems very sort of very abstract.
It's very abstract, and you could show positions where it's actually concrete, like immediately concrete. What you mean, that does that make sense? Like the idea.
Yeah, it does. Well, and that gets back to Alex's question. So any chance you would make a course about this, a Chessable course, perhaps?
Yeah, so there's two questions. Is the answer to D4, we're making a Chessable course on Fajarowicz, which has been challenging because it's very, very Fajarowicz Budapest gambit. So it's a gambit. So people
That's
do
the one with knight E4?
Knight E4, yeah.
Okay. So it goes D4, knight up, just for the listeners, D4, sure, knight up, so 6, D4, E5 takes knight E4. Okay.
Yes. Exactly. It's more extreme than the normal Budapest gambit, which is already a gambit. So, and it's not, people do not think of these things as colors. I'll be honest, in the past, years back, I did not as well think of, like, tactical positions are tactics. It is, take it for what it is. It's not the dash. It's not a strategic, but over time I realized that everything is colors. It's just the rules of chess and it's happening all the time. So we're going to, yeah. In that course, it's close to being out. And it's going to be very, very color-based. That's number one. And number two, for just general color education, me and Elijah, we're working on, we started it on an academy, which I don't know, my website, whatever. I'll give the website. But it's about colors, like showing how all the world champions think about colors. Now, they're not thinking about colors. I don't think. They don't need it. Okay, if you're Carlson's level... Capablanca's level, you don't need that. You just know everything. Fair enough.
Yeah, you don't need that framing, but you're saying they illustrate the ideas that...
Exactly. But since we're not that, so we could learn from that in that framework, and we could actually, I think, see a game, which otherwise is instructive already, but learn more. I think it just helps the learning process, the framing to learn.
Okay, interesting. And speaking of Elijah, so again, longtime listeners will have heard my interview with Elijah. He's a very hardworking chess student and a successful Chessable creator and teacher. Did your collaboration start from you coaching him? Did I pick that up from one of your videos?
I did. We coached for a while, and then one day I decided, you know what? It'd be nice. Go out on a limb. We'll try to do something new. And like he's doing courses, it'll be fun to make a course together. So I called him, and then we started, and we did the Stonewall. We did the Carol Kahn, Stonewall / Cheesecake for white, D4. For black, it was the Carol Kahn. And now we're doing for Jarrah, which is the most challenging of all because there are a lot of variations, and we're trying to make it intuitive and color based. So it's cool. It's actually, I'm learning myself while doing it. Like
I'm surprised. I would have guessed fewer variations because it's so offbeat. I mean, in your opponents, I feel like often wouldn't know what to do.
That's true. It's like, you know what it is? In Carol Kahn, we would say like, all right, you're fine. Just use the colors. Like you'll be okay.
Here, oh, you have to, yeah. You have
here,
to work.
Like here, actually, I feel responsibility not letting people totally astray. Because I feel like here, one move and you're dead every time. So
high risk, high reward.
Can you say that again?
High risk, high reward.
High risk, high reward. And it's cool because I think we're giving color perspective in the most extreme situations. And that reminds me of the word dacha is actually not my own. Well, it's a Russian word. It means a summer home. Mm-hmm. So that goal is that when you're building in harmony, you're trying to build a beautiful summer home on the chessboard. And that came from me and my friend Mark Esserman. Mark Esserman, a long time. He's one of my oldest chess friends, my closest, if not the closest. And we grew up together playing on ICC when we were little, like 12 or 13. We met in New York like 5 or 6 years later. And we talked a lot about these color ideas and developed it together. He's certainly the word dacha. Like one time, it was in 2004 in Fort Lauderdale in the US Open. He told me a Petrosian quote. He said, because of the Dutch, I built my dacha. That's what Trojan said.
That's a great Trojan quote. Wow.
Yeah. And it was basically to the idea, like literally speaking, really what he meant is he won so many games against the Dutch because he would punish them on like all the weak squares. He just loved it. He had built a home. But we kind of, he said like, well, it could also be, and maybe together we thought about it, how you're actually building a home on the Dutch, like a home on that. And that's when the dacha word came in. But in terms of drugs, no, there was no drugs involved. And it was in Israel. Actually, in Israel 2002, a little before that, I was playing in Petach. I lived there for a year and a half studying. I was becoming, at one point, thinking about becoming a rabbi. So I was studying a lot there. It was nice. I played more chess than rabbi studies. So
here you are. Yeah.
And here we are. exactly. And I was in Petah Tikva. I was playing some good plays, some 2400. And I was playing the Stonewall, I think. And he had a bishop pair. He had two bishops. And I had two knights. And there was a square that was really important. It was a c4 square, I remember. And I had a knight on c4. And he had a light square bishop. The c4, the light square. Or, you know, but maybe the listeners. So c4, light square, okay. And his bishop was trying to crush me. Light bishop trying to crush me on that diagonal. And I had another knight protecting it. And his two bishops could do nothing to my knights. And I was firmly controlling light. And I'm like, it's nice. But I was wondering, like, why? It was just more like a existential thing during the game, like curious why, because they say the bishops outrun the knights, outplay the knights. Why am I clearly making a mockery of the bishops? And then I came to me like, because both knights are light bishops. Okay, started thinking about that, and then it got me thinking about how bishop, and then for a while I actually told my students that knights are better than bishops. I was just wrong. So I told them years later, I was just like, okay, sorry guys, I'm wrong. Wrong. But the right track is wrong because knights are both colors, but bishops are intense on the color. And then I thought about the color money, 1,500, and mini bishops came to my mind. And it just started forming. And it was something all new. And I was like, wait, is this even true? Like, seems new. I'm like, curious, wait. And like, I decided to look at a Kasparov-Karpov games to see if if I could see it in their games. And if I couldn't, I'd be like, I don't know. Like, I don't want to see it. And I was very pleasantly happy to see it. Karpov always trading a bishop for a knight and using pressing the color of the knight and rebuilding. And I felt really happy to see all that.
Yeah, I mean, it's an interesting approach. But like you say, I mean, I think with examples, it would become a lot more clear. Yeah. And certainly, you know, color complexes obviously are a highly educational theme generally. Yeah. When you study these greats like Karpov's games. But Yakov, I got one other major topic I wanted to discuss. This has been a lot of fun. I really appreciate it. You mentioned, of course, studying in Israel, and I know that you were raised with an Orthodox Jewish background. So I'm curious, like, how chess and religion intersected for you, both like growing up and in adulthood.
So, like, example, yeah, that's it was always. I don't know if this is okay to say on the air. I could take it out if not, but. That chess magazines were my playboy.
Really, like it's
nothing more, nothing less. Exact. I would just like it's. I would never, like, people say studying chess, and I understand that. But I never even thought of it like that. Just enjoying chess, like you study a playboy, and like no, okay, maybe. But that's it was just I love the studies and stuff, and I was very good at it. I loved certain parts. Certain parts were probably a little much for me. Certain the restrictions. So that was what it was. But overall it was just beautiful, but chess was a good balance where I think chess, you just did anything. Chess, anything goes. It was like a really free, 100% freedom. Like you, everything goes, and you have to feel that you have to not hold back. I think that's hard to do. I feel it sometimes. I'm just in that zone where you just know you don't care and you just play. Sometimes you're holding back maybe because of how it looks, maybe pride. I don't know. This and that, or could just be you're afraid of like Ikara, like just a little stifles you, but you have to be free. And that was a good balance where I think I felt pretty free, but I think there were some things that was a bit extreme. I didn't fully feel myself, maybe. And chess was a good balance for that. I think it was a really nice balance.
So there were certain activities you weren't allowed to do as a kid?
Yeah, like I was at one point even very, very religious, which was. Yeah, religious was probably fine for me, but very religious, like no girl, it was all boys school. Was really extreme. And so chess for me was, I would remember during lunch, I would go out to the library every day and play on ICC. And that was a good time. That was, it kind of balanced. It kept me in a good state.
And then I understand you had there were some periods when you were playing competitively where you would play during Shabbat.
Yeah. Oh, that's an awesome question. Okay. Research. Oh my god, that's awesome. Yeah. Okay. And I forgot that was in U.S. Championship. Oh, in Iceland a couple times when I got my IM norms. Example: IM norms. My buddy Michael Krugliak, who has been a best friend whole life, and he was. If not for him, I don't get IM. I don't make IM because he. I didn't think like that. I guess this is about, I made it in 2013, but I don't know. I was just enjoying chess. I would teach a little bit at the back then. I would teach, but not too much. Actually, a decent chunk already. But I wouldn't care too much about tournaments. But he said, oh, let's go to Iceland. Let's go to Bahamas. I'm like, oh, yeah, that sounds fun. And I played, but the games were on Shabbat. Can't write down the moves. So I would have stickers. Actually, the U.S. Championship particularly, they were strict. In Iceland, they allowed me to do without writing. But in U.S. Championship, they said, no, it's very strict. So I have stickers, a book full of chess positions where I put a sticker on as the move. Huh. And actually, Yasser, Sarwan, he did a commentary there. He would nickname me Stickers. I was like, so it was pleasant.
Any objections from your opponents?
No, not the stickers. No, that's normal. For the clock. I forgot what we did for the clock, but no, not at all. Actually, in Iceland, there was one of my opponents hit the clock for me.
Oh, wow.
And frankly, we were in time pressure, and he was really, really nice. And I'll tell you this, I ended up swindling him, and I can't help but thinking that.
Jeez, no good deed goes unpunished, right?
Well, exactly. Looking back, I feel like I owe him a thank you. I see him I have to remember who it is, but... was a Ukrainian GM. I forget his name now. Anyway, he was really nice. And right, good, no good data because I'm punished. Exactly. But yeah, the Shabbat, and we would prepare food, kosher food and stuff. And yeah.
And did you have personal interactions with Yasser when he was calling you Stickers?
Absolutely. Oh, I didn't really talk about the Stickers, but actually in the U.S. Championship, so that was a highlight of my chess, where I was like, worked really hard to get my rating up. And I would play Westfield every single Sunday, and I didn't lose. I just like, all right, I would just farm. They call it like farming. I would just farm.
So these are like local quads for local. Less local listeners. And you're probably playing mostly lower rated players, right?
Well, absolutely. I was around 2,500. So one of my students, I'm Scott Swerlin, I remember I taught his kid, Ryan Swerlin, a decade ago. And he said, yeah, you should be, I was like 2,300. He said, you should be 2,500. And he motivated. I decided, all right, let's do it. And I just played a lot. I got up. Once I hit 2,500, I decided, you know what? I'm not that far from qualifying. And I played the quads every Sunday. And I, they were mostly 2,250s or so, 2,300s. And yeah, it was good. But, you know, Yasser, so I got the U.S. champion. That was really, really, really what an experience. And Yasser was – I came there, I was frightened. I told Yasser before, the day before when I had the ceremony before. I was like, Yasser, I'm afraid I will lose every game, and I don't want to go down in history as losing. That's – I think that's one for – anyway, I think that, like, someone – I remember hearing, like, one player lost every game. I don't want to be that. It's just not going to feel good. I was actually frightened. And he said, oh – don't worry, Jakob. I promise you, you will not lose every game. And that made me feel happy. I felt like he gave me a guarantee. So, like, okay,
I mean, he's got the soothing voice, so you just start talking and you feel better, right?
Exactly. Even what he said and just the voice already, exactly. And I did well. I did a form above my rating. But he was really, you know, it really made a difference. It really, really made a difference. I was very afraid. I made a difference. So,
any other memories from that U.S. Championship?
Yeah, it was nice. I remember Larry Christensen crushing me and Shanklin crushing me. Everyone jumped on me. Carol Kahn, one of my lines of the Bronstein Larson. They all played again. They all punished me. Because the problem was that I'm very easy to prepare, and it's still a problem. I'm really easy to prepare against. I kind of like an opening. I just don't, and I'm stubborn.
Yeah, you say you've been playing them for like 25 years plus, right?
Yeah, that's what I say. Who said that?
You said it in your Chessable video.
Yes. Exactly. So it's just to say it's easy maybe is an even understatement. It's just really easy. But I've tried to like revamp the lines, but for the course I had to like get it tight. So I worked on some of the issues. But I mean, like anything, if someone, you know, I think I fixed up the stuff. But again, if at the time I didn't know some of that, and if someone knows what you're gonna do, yeah, it's not obviously ideal, especially at this level.
I mean, players at that level, that's
level,
like...
Exactly.
It totally makes sense. Well, Yakov, this has been great. Just a couple other things before we go. Number one, I know you're sort of rolling out a chess academy in addition to the Chessable courses and the sort of targeted lessons that you're doing. Could you tell our listeners about your vision for that?
Yeah, I think it's really, really cool. I've gotten some good reviews. And if I could just mention something I really wanted to say. One of my students, I never mentioned, Levi Rosman used to be my student.
You buried the lead.
I forgot. I know it's the last, it's like in therapy. The last thing you say is like the important, is very important.
All right, let's hear the little Levi stories. I've heard him from his perspective. He describes himself as like a young tyrant when he was a kid, obviously talented at chess. But what are your memories of Levi?
I didn't teach him for that long, but I taught him the Stonewall. I also taught him like the color ideas. So like, flattering. He mentions, he's definitely inspired by the color ideas. If you look closely, you'll see, like, he talk it, like the light and dark money, like it sometimes, he was talented. I mean, he was talented, motivated. And I didn't think he was listening that closely, but I see a decade later, he's inspired by the idea. So like, that's pretty cool. Definitely motivated.
And let me ask you, as someone who knew him from a little kid, you probably heard when he was starting to make content. Has his rise surprised you?
His rise in chess?
In content. I mean, in really.
Oh, it's unbelievable. I mean, it's unbelievable. I mean, I he's like the god of god. I mean, I'm just trying to learn. And I tell my Mike, who helps me with the academy, and I'm like, listen, everything he does, everything Levi does is gold. We gotta learn a little at a time. I mean... You know, the chess, he's a great player too, but what he's doing, it's just gold, everything.
It's so amazing,
it's unbelievable. So I'm trying to, and someone told me this, Jakob, your videos are awesome and they're as good, if not even better than Levy's. I mean, obviously it's not subjective, but it was a big compliment to me. But obviously everything he does is balanced and funny and a lot of things and everything. So I'm trying to incorporate.
Amazing. That's funny. So, okay, bringing it back to your academy, you should have it on the webpage, you know, teacher, you taught at Levy everything he knows, but anyway, go on.
I know. It would be fun though. I'm going to reach out to him actually. It'd be like kind of collaborating, like, and then talk about colors on one time together. It would be interesting. Not everything he knows, by the way, but I know you. But yeah, it would be fun to tell this, yeah. But yeah, so the academy, we're working on is making videos and really, really educate. I felt like I'm teaching mostly for years. I'm teaching one-on-one mostly, some in schools as well, but I teach mostly one-on-one, mostly adults. I love teaching adults. I mean, kids is not for, I like a more relaxed approach. Kids, it gets a little intense. The parents hate me because I tell their kids, don't do homework. Like, just do whatever you want to do. Like, this is, so like, kids love me. Parents, the problem is the kids the one paying. Doesn't work. Logistics don't add up. So yeah. But adults, I a lot of people have told me this is my favorite hour of the week. And they just enjoy it and learn a lot too. And I think the color ideas sound intimidating, but very, very quickly they become very easy to use. And it's nice. So I'm working on for people that generally, and people, lessons a lot of time for people and money. So it's just the academy, which I think is great education. Is a good fit for people, and it's basically making videos, 1 to 2 videos a week. We already have 28 videos, and it's going through every world champion and like some of the best players from Morphe, seeing how Morphe used color ideas, which is kind of cool because it's not, we don't think of it like that, and it's interesting to me as I do it. And we're having a situation where people could ask me questions during the week and send me games. And it's very, I think it's a great learning tool. And they're playing, well, the members play me a correspondence chess and we talk about the game as it goes. So it's a one-on-one experience. And Elijah's helping out too. He's making some group lessons with the members.
Excellent. Well, we will link to that. And in closing, Yaakov, we got to ask you sort of the proverbial question. Since you are working primarily with adult students, if someone says, hey, Yaakov, I have 10 hours a week to do chess, like how do you tell them to spend that time?
Yeah. 10 hours, including lessons, not lessons on their own. Like I know it's
yeah. Let's say, including lessons,
including lessons. Okay. I think an hour or two a week is ideal. Got to join the academy. There you go. You got to join the academy. No. So I'm making it cheap. I'm probably too cheap, but like $10 is like the cheapest tier. That's 50. Like it's
per month.
Per month. Yeah.
So it's that is inexpensive.
Yeah, and I believe it's actually really like solid. I really am personalized, so I think it's be good. Going well so far. But yeah, for that, I think people should just read a lot of books. Like just read books and don't think so much about what you're doing. I think after you read, when you read, don't think like, well, what did I learn from this? And try to like think, just read a lot of endgame books and not like technical endgames. Learn from like the Capablanca, see his games. That's why I like Irving Chernev. And he's like a cheerleader. Yeah. He makes it fun. And you can get in that feeling. And at the very least, if you learn nothing, you'll have a good time.
Well said. Yeah. I love it. Yeah, I'm working on a book, sort of compiled wisdom of perpetual chess guests. And one of the topics that I get into is like this sort of debate about like with endgames, do you study the technical endings? You know, do you memorize certain positions or do you just sort of watch the masters in action? So given what you just said, I might have to quote you in it, Yaakov.
Nice. Absolutely. Oh, beautiful. I would be honored.
Okay. Excellent. All right. Well, Yaakov, this has been a lot of fun. So many great stories from your rise up the ranks. Anything to add before we say our goodbyes?
Yeah, I guess, does that make sense if I give, should I give the website link or maybe I should?
I mean, you could say, if it's like it rolls off the tongue, you could tell me, but mainly I generally like anything for websites and Chessable courses and social media. If you have any, like I'll put it in the show description, but sure, it can't hurt to mention the website's name.
Website, www.yakattack.com, but like the spelling
is... Oh, that's easy enough.
Easy enough, right? It's like my name, Yak, well, it's two A's, so Y-A-A-C and Attack, and that's my same name for Chessable, so yeah, that's why I'm, I think it's a fun name. I couldn't even find a perfect... Yak Attack is chill.
That's pretty good, yeah.
Thank you. Like Yak, because the Yak is like a buffalo, you know, so it's whatever, it's a play on words, but Yak, Y-A-A-C, attack.com, and that's... But is right now the academy is using just Patreon, well, which is fine. But I think I'm trying to expand it to make it its own site. Anyway, but for now, the yakattack.com has everything.
Okay, excellent. Well, we will link to that, Yakov. And after all these years, it was good to finally hear your stories firsthand.
Thank you so much. Thank you.
Listeners, one other detail that I am Yakov Norowitz forgot to mention. If you do check out his academy, he will give free 1 month previews. That's at yakattack.com. And I will link to it and everything else we discuss in the show description. Thanks for listening. Catch you all next week. Thanks to everyone who helps make Perpetual Chess possible. Big shout out to my producer, Matthew Passy. I'd also like to thank the Blue Wire Podcast Network, with whom we are proud to be affiliated. Be sure to follow us on social media, BennyFishel1 on Twitter, at Perpetual Chess on Instagram, and or you can join the Perpetual Chess Facebook group. You can email me, ben@perpetualchesspod.com. And of course, last but not least, I'd like to give major thanks to the Perpetual Chess Patreon and PayPal supporters. Those who choose to join that community based on their level of support can do things like submit questions for guests of the show, have access to live Zoom Q&A lectures with grandmasters who often have appeared on the show, going over chess games, answering questions, stuff like that. And you can even get access to ad-free Perpetual Chess if that's your preference. So, but most of all, thanks to everyone for listening, and we will catch you all on...
Podcast Network.